Hey, what's going on, everybody? I'm Dorian, and I want to welcome you to Highway to Scale, a podcast in which we explore the ins and outs of business success, and where we cover topics like validating business ideas, exploring different management styles, building products, launching them on the market, raising capital, and scaling your business. If this is your first time listening to Highway to Scale, here's a big fat welcome to our little community. And while we're getting to know each other, I want to ask you to click on that subscribe button and add us to your podcast playlist so you'll get notified when we publish new interviews. On the other hand, if you've been following us since the previous season, you know that we love and appreciate your support, so it's amazing to have you back with us as we explore new companies and their business strategies. In today's episode, I'm joined by Jonathan, who is the co-founder and CEO of Allgravy, a financial wellness app for hourly paid employees. Allgravy gives them a live payslip and full control over their money. With Allgravy, they have an overview of their earnings, bills, and savings goals, and access to their salary as soon as they have finished their shift. As for Jonathan, he's a former management consultant turned entrepreneur. Since the dark days of consulting, he's focused on the startup world, working on the venture side, helping create startups and scaling scale-ups, always with a keen focus on customer-led products. In this podcast, Jonathan will tell us more about the current state of the gig economy and how businesses can improve their employees' financial well-being. So let's cut the intro and let's jump right into the episode to see what Jonathan can teach us about building a business. Jonathan, welcome to Highway to Scale.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Jonathan, let's start with the basics. Can you tell me a little bit more about your, you know, business beginnings? How did you decide to become an entrepreneur?
Sure. Well, I started like in a slightly boring place, I guess, as a management consultant. I always loved strategy and finance, so I kind of went in there to learn the ropes. So was helping investment banks, retail banks, the European Central Bank with very complex modeling. Within a few years, I kind of felt like I'd learned what I needed to learn and then want to get into the entrepreneurial way of life. I think I was still a little bit of a chicken when I started, so didn't dare do my own startup. So I became an advisor for a few startups, came back to Denmark and was an entrepreneur in residence for a venture studio, kind of learning the ropes in a safe environment. Then helped build a company called Nordic Knowledge Partners, a small successful company in the Nordics. And joined a company called User Tribe that I helped scale from 20 to 55 people, led the commercial team there. And I think after these experiences, I felt like I had the learnings of how to do 0 to 1, 2 to 10, and then 20 to 50. So I felt confident enough to try and go out and build my own company.
Great, great, amazing. So tell me a little bit more about Allgravy. How did it all start? What's the grand vision behind the company?
Sure. So I guess those are two kind of different questions. How it all started was really, I wanted to do something that was positive for the world. So I looked at a few different spaces where I could see that I could make a difference. Started with impact investing, realized there's a lot of people trying to solve that and I don't have any unique insights. But very quickly zoned in on hourly paid workers or frontline workers, as we also tend to call them. That was really inspired by my mom. My mom's an immigrant in Denmark. She's always been a waitress. And just seeing her way of dealing with money was a bit of an inspiration in terms of that's not the optimal way. And no one really helps these hourly paid workers with their money, right? The banks don't care because they don't have enough money to go out and get a mortgage. They can't invest a lot of money in equity. So they don't really care. So I thought that's a really interesting group to try and help. Second thing is financial services has become a commodity. Anyone can really create a current account and a debit card if they have a good developer team using off-the-shelf solutions. So there's suddenly these new opportunities to help this or specific audiences that have problems. And the third one was just looking to the US, where I saw a few earned wage access players that were kind of rethinking how to think about salary. And I think all these three things together started to form an idea around what eventually became Allgravy. So I just started interviewing a lot of bartenders, waitresses, nurses, gig workers working for delivery companies and trying to understand, like, how does their financial world work? What gives them frustrations? When do they get stressed? And how do you think about motivation for work? And found some different interesting points. One was they had, in general, pretty poor overview of their finances, because not only did they need to manage the cost side, right? Do they have enough money for rent, for fitness, for any savings they want to do? But they also have to manage the income side. How do they get enough hours to cover that?
Yep,
how much money do they have left for themselves? So it's a lot more complex for them just to get that transparency. So I thought that was one interesting thing. The other thing is they tended to take a lot of extra shifts at the end of a salary period when they were closer to payday. So that's naturally an issue for the companies, because then they only get those shifts taken, not the ones at the start of the period.
Mm-hmm.
But also shows that with a few little changes, you can actually motivate people to increase their income. So it's really about giving them that kind of safety that, you know, my bills are covered, and then also giving them that freedom that if I take an extra shift, I can go out with my friends, or I can, you know, buy that TV I've been looking at, or whatever it is. So that's really the vision in terms of what we want to do, is really help hourly paid workers feel safe that they've got their costs covered, and feel that freedom that they can actually take some extra work and do what they want to do with that money.
You started your company in 2020. You know, in the midst of the COVID pandemic. Can you tell me, how did this affect your company? Was there, you know, a sudden surge of new users wanting to, join the platform, or was it something different?
Well, it affected us in a few different ways, right? Like we're B2B2C companies, so we sell to companies. Given that most of our customers, we go for the hospitality companies, those are the ones that we help primarily. Most of them were closed, right? So there wasn't a lot of customers to kind of take from. So that was a little bit of an issue. But on the other hand, the owners then had a lot of time to talk, right? And we're super user research driven. So we had a big opportunity to do that user research and actually scale up with the companies as they came back from COVID. I think on a more sort of like operational level within the company, I didn't meet my co-founder for the first 3 months because you know, he was having a kid and was scared of COVID. So we just used Zoom. So it was a bit of a special relationship there, like meeting for the first time actually after we got funding.
Now that you mentioned your co-founder, what's the relationship between the two of you when it comes to building a company? A lot of people say that, you know, starting a company with a co-founder is a sort of a risk because you never know how the relationship is going to turn out. How do you ensure that you're working, you know, great and that the company is growing?
You can never ensure that, right? I think you're right. Like, similar to how you can't know that a partner is going to be right for you over the years, but you can do a lot of things to help that. And I think we were really aware of that from the start because we weren't great friends. We just met through a common friend. So what we did at the start actually was I needed to get the MVP done. You know, I sold it to a few companies. And, you know, we liked each other and had a lot of chats, but we're like, we can't co-found something together without having worked together. So he said, why don't I build the MVP? We see if we enjoy it. And then, you know, I'll pay him some money if we don't enjoy working together. So it came like in a soft way that we were like slowly working together. And we're like, actually, we're super aligned on stuff like employee equity. We want to give out a lot. Culture. We want to be a fun place to work. We want to work with the, you know, best people in the world and give them freedom to actually thrive. So I think the more kind of things we discussed, the more we realized we were aligned. And therefore we're just like, okay, let's just co-found this all gravy together. But then I think there's more things to do, right? Because one thing is kind of agreeing that you can work together. The second thing we did is we got a coach that you could say almost works like as a relationship therapist. Exactly. So like, you know, sees like, these are probably the places that you're going to get into like small fights or conflicts. Like, beware when you talk about this, this is how, you know, Christian thinks, or this is how Jonathan thinks about it. So having those conversations, I think, early on and ongoing has been very helpful in terms of taking the edge off what can be, you know, it's an intense thing building a startup together. So that's been pretty important for us.
So who's focused on what? You're focused more on business. Your co-founder is focused more on tech, or?
Yeah. So Christian is the CTO. So he manages the engineering team. And I'm focused on commercial fundraising. I come out of the user research end and have a lot of financial experience. So I'm also very much in the product, but that's really a co-working experience between us. It's a classic CTO-CEO split.
Now, when we talk about All Gravy, what are you currently focused on the most? What are some of the next steps that you're going to take with the company?
Yeah, so I mean, there's a few things. We just raised a seed round, and this money is going to be spent on one, building a repeatable growth engine. The second thing is going into the UK, which is also a big one for us. And I think, you know, we started as a product company. That's all we've been focused on. Our first hire was a developer, then a user researcher, and we've really just scaled up on research, development, and design. And we've had one salesperson that's kind of like kept the engine running a little bit.
Now we
shift focus a little bit. Obviously, we come out of a product DNA. We still do our user research a lot, but we also need to focus on actually getting into the market and getting that sort of like commercial motion going. So that's our biggest focus for the next 1.5 years. The second thing, and it's really related to this, is given that we sell into B2B companies, and we've had such a big focus on the end users, we're not finished there, right? But we have a product that users love. They log in on average 13 times a month. They retain,
great,
I think 72% of them after 3 months. Like it's a very good product we have in the market now. We're now shifting our product focus a little bit to the people that are actually paying for our services, which is the companies. So creating some dashboards for them, some insights that can help them understand like who's about to churn, and helping them a little bit with flexibility of their workforce. So if they have multiple brands within the same company, they can actually shift employees around within that company. So helping them a little bit as well as the end users.
So can you tell me a little bit more about how does your platform work? How does it work for companies and how does it work for end users?
For sure. Let's start with the end user and then jump into the company. So the end user, when they log into the app, instantly they see an overview of how much have I earned this month? What will that give me after tax? They can then see, they can put in their bills and any savings goals. Then they can see, okay, will I cover my bills with my expected salary? Will I have enough for the savings goal I have? And then how much do I have left for myself? So there's always this financial overview and gamification, right? So as soon as they take an extra shift, it's like, okay, now I have this much for myself. They get a high five when they finish a shift and these kind of things. And then on top of that, we have this earned salary access. So as soon as they finish a shift, they can go into the app and press withdraw. They put in the amount of money they want and they get it instantly paid to their bank account at no fee. So that's the users.
And now about the companies?
Jumping into the business. So we've been operating or building our product to be as frictionless as possible. So we're just a layer that companies put in. It takes about 10, 15 minutes to set up. We go into the workforce management system so we can see exactly how much has the users worked, how much are they planning to work, what will they get paid per hour. And we go into the payroll software so we can say if a user takes out, say, 50 euros, then they don't get paid that again when they get paid their salary. And we just get repaid as part of the salary process, so it doesn't impact liquidity of the companies.
So how does that aspect work? Because a lot of companies pay their, you know, hourly workers or gig workers at the end of, you know, their payment period, like, say, once a month. You said that workers can basically withdraw money immediately after they finish their shift, let's say.
Exactly.
How does that work?
Operationally, the way it works is we effectively have an account for each company within a bank. And then as soon as we can see in our systems that a user has finished some work and how much they've earned, the user can then just request that money. And we have an integration with banks that basically allows us to wire money directly to the user. We've taken all of the complexity out of it. So we just handle the accounting and the operations of it on our side. And then at the end of the month, the company just gets a bill that's paid automatically where they pay back whatever we've sent out to the user.
That sounds amazing because it really helps, you know, hourly workers and gig workers. They usually earn a lot less than people who are hired, you know, full time. So it really helps them out, you know, okay, if I need something immediately, I can just withdraw it, pay it, and I'm fine. I really don't need to, you know, wait for the end of the month or the beginning of the next month and, you know, be scared if I'm really going to have enough money to cover all of the expenses.
Exactly. And there's a few different situations where this is super useful, right? Like, for example, you break your phone. Like, usually you'd have to go out and take a payday loan or something like that to pay for that because you need it immediately, right? You can't. Or a better example is your bike. If you're, like, delivering for someone mm-hmm. like Uber Eats, right? And you like your bike breaks, then suddenly you can't work, right? So having access yeah. to that money rather than have to go into debt is fantastic. The second thing that we see is money is not just money, right? Money is something that people have a lot of emotions on. That's why user research is so important for us. It's not just mm-hmm. like a mechanical thing. For example, a lot of users we have, they have savings and they want to put into their savings every month, right? And there's a lot of like guilt related to taking money out of their savings, right? And once they yeah, start taking yeah. money out of the savings, then it's like endless. They can keep on going, right? Where mm-hmm. we do a very clear link between you do some work and there's some pay for it. And you can do a little bit of extra work and you take that money out, right? So yeah, if you take
yeah, yeah.
some extra work and then you do something, then you don't have this guilt related to it. Well, and you can like keep that savings bucket on its own. So there's a lot that just isn't necessarily rational, but it's related to emotions that just becomes possible once you have this direct link between work and pay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You shifted the entire story towards rewarding
exactly
workers instead of, you know, punishing them for spending their savings. That's great. That's great.
Exactly. And I think there's a lot of companies that have used like these little mechanics. I'm not sure if you've been investing via an investment app, right? But whenever you log mm-hmm. in, it's like, oh, you're 2% up, you're 1% down.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there's actually no action that makes sense for you to do based on that fact, but you keep checking it, right? Because it's like it's mm-hmm. pretty addictive. So our thinking is there a way that we can use these dynamics to actually get the users to do a positive action, right? And for us, a positive action is increasing your own income, right? So if they see, okay, yeah, it was a bit like annoying to have to go to work on a Thursday, but I got this much money, so there's mm-hmm. some instant reward, right? So creating this link was really important for us.
Yeah, as you mentioned, that gamification aspect.
Exactly.
You immediately see, okay, I've done an additional shift. I yeah. can already see that I get, you know, as you said, a high five, and you see, yeah. okay, I earned this much. Exactly. It's a great experience. Yeah. yeah
and the
yeah.
the results are amazing, right? So what the businesses get out of it is on average 20% more shifts taken per user. Right? Wow. So there's a real business win to actually giving your users financial wellness.
Now, Jonathan, you talked about the entire space that you're working in. Can you tell me a little bit more about your competitors and what makes your company better than them?
Sure. There is a lot of competition. It depends a little bit how you define the space, right? But mm-hmm. if we take like earned wage access and financial wellness, I think there is a lot of competition within the space. Even in Denmark, where we are today, there's another company that does some earned wage access. You can get mm-hmm. access to your money 2 days after you've earned it. And I think to make the discussion a little bit more interesting, maybe I should go a bit broader and talk about like the European market. Yeah. Because we're going into the UK now, so it's going to be increasingly relevant. And you know, we mm-hmm. have we've had great chats with the other companies, so it's not like I see us as being in furious battle with each other. But if mm-hmm. I look at like the ways they've gone about it, they've taken a very different approach to us. Well, basically every other company I've seen in this space have gone for every employee out there, right? Whether you're full time mm-hmm. or you're hourly paid, and I can see why you do that, because you get a much bigger market. And if you think earned wage access on its own is really important, then you know, why not go for it? And you have companies like WageStream, who I think are incredibly impressive. They've gone for they're going down the full banking route, right? They're saying, okay, all employees should have banking through their employer, so that's what we're gonna provide them, which I think is an interesting way of doing it. And I think they've done incredibly well on sales, right? You have other companies and I think we're kind of moving from earned wage access 1.0, which is just about let's give people their money as soon as they've mm-hmm. earned it, into like what comes after that, right? Because that's just the start of the market. That's a wedge in. But what do you build on the back of that? And I think that's where we've been super active in thinking about like how do we increase the wellness of these hourly paid workers? These are people that have agency over their income. They have specific challenges related to that. Okay, let's just look at them and see how can we build something that's exciting to them. For us, that's one, obviously like letting them know when it makes sense to take an extra shift to actually cover their bills, right? Because that's a unique challenge they have that no one else has, but also a unique opportunity they have. How can we help them create savings goals and actually put it in a world that makes sense for them, right? A savings goal is usually something your bank gives you. It says, okay, you earn €1,000 a month. Mm-hmm. Out of that, put €100 aside, and that goes into savings, right? Yeah, for us, like, well, you want to save up this much. If you do want to save up that much, we suggest you take these two shifts that are available with your employer, right? And then we also increase the availability of shifts within your employer. So if your employer has multiple brands, suddenly instead of just working at one of the brands, you can jump over and work at another one where there's a need. So we're really focused on the unique challenges that the employees have. And on top of that, we then also go in and solve issues that these employers have. The employers that have flexible workforces, that have hourly paid workers. One is the financial wellness issue. The second one is really understanding their employees and when are they happy, when are they not happy? Are you having issues with churn? Is it worse than the industry mm-hmm. average? All of these things we're going in and taking. So we're taking the kind of ecosystem route in the hospitality, retail, and gig working space. So I think there's the banking route, there's the ecosystem route, and then there's also a route which is trying to do payroll or simply just doing earned wage access. So I think that's our take on it. We're super vertically specialized. We look at the problems that hourly paid workers have, and we're super product-led. And I think that's what's going to make the difference.
You mentioned expanding to the UK. Can you tell me a little bit more about the process? How did you choose UK as the next country?
I'll talk like a bit generically rather than going into the specifics about why we chose the UK. But I think for us that there's a few different things, right? Like how big is the market? Because there's an entry cost to going into any market, and it's not that different from market to market. So you want to go into a market that actually has a size where it makes sense. You want to see that there's some tendencies in the market that makes it viable for you. Like, do they like using digital banking products? Is there a proven need for earned wage access? What's the competitive pressure like? Do you think you can bring something unique to that market? And it's not uniformly bad that there's competitive pressure, right? Because that also means that you have a more educated market. Then you also need to look at the regulatory environment. For someone like us, it's not just the financial regulation, but it's also looking at like labor laws, like how much do you need to customize to go into a market?
Yeah.
Taking all these factors into account, the UK was the most attractive market to us.
When it comes to some of your, let's say, business strategies for growing that market, for growing your baseline number of users, what proved to be great up until now? And what will be some of your future activities that you'll want to, you know, conduct?
Yeah, so I think we've tried quite a few different things, right? And what's turned out to be the case, I think, also with the type of customers we have, is it's the old school method of direct outbound is really proven to be what works. I think over time, we'll see stuff like referrals work better. Like we're already seeing a little bit as one end user jumps from one company to another. They say, hey, I had Old Gravy at this company. Now I want it at the new company, right? But it takes a while to build up that pressure. So until you have a certain size, you know, one employee saying that is not necessarily going to make the difference. But once you have 5, 6, 10 employees saying that, that's going to make a pretty big difference. So then we can accelerate that a little bit. But I think for us, it's about creating that kind of like knock it through the outbound strategies, adding a little bit of digital marketing, and then getting those referral programs up and running.
So when we talk about, you know, sales and marketing, how is your core team currently structured?
So actually, we have gone for like a fairly unique strategy. We had someone who was head of customer success with a lot of experience within sales that we've now set to be the director of both sales, customer success, and marketing. So you actually have all of those functions working very tightly together.
Great.
But you know, for a team like us, it's also about keeping it simple, right? It's outbound that's working. So it's setting up these sort of SDRs, the AEs, and then reporting into something and having very clear targets. So that's really how we're doing it. I think as long as you're educating a market and they're not searching for you, there's a limit to how much you can get out of the classic growth engine.
When we talk about hiring and expanding your team, you currently have around 20 employees, if I'm not mistaken.
More like 15, but yeah.
Who will you be hiring the most in the next period?
Salespeople. It's our product team works incredibly well. It's well set up to scale and build new product lines. So for now, it's really getting those AEs in both in Denmark, but also setting up the commercial team in the UK. So that's our only focus for now.
And when it comes to, you know, the mindset of those people? What kind of traits are you looking for in new hires?
Yeah, so I think it's, you know, salespeople are a... it's different hiring salespeople to hiring product people, right? With product people, you're looking for some different traits, because like selling is lonely, right? And you get targets that you have to hit like constantly, and it's constantly seen if you're doing well, if you're not doing well. So I think like hiring salespeople is a pretty kind of like unique thing. But what we're looking for is, you know, a lot of optimism and positivity, ability to motivate yourself, and then, you know, as I was hinting a little bit to, is this collaboration element, actually being able to collaborate with customer success, with the marketing team, and working across that. And, you know, for a company, I think for any company, it's actually important that the sales team and the product team are working together. So you can't have these like super alpha salespeople come in and just like, hunt their target and not care about anything else. You need to have that collaborative element up there. But, you know, testing for whether people are good salespeople or not is just very difficult.
Now, when we talk about the growth of your company within the industry, what would be some challenges that you will need to, you know, tackle in order to grow your company further?
I mean, there's a natural barrier of going from one country to another, right? Like we've seen what works in Denmark, but like the English market is a different market to the Danish market. Like how exactly is that going to work out? We're definitely going to have some product adaptations, right? Like, for example, credit card debt is a very different thing in the UK. The way they make decisions within companies is probably quite different. The sheer size of the companies is very different. So there's a lot of like unknowns within the UK. And we just had a UK general manager. Like his first job is going to be, you know, running against a wall, hitting his head. I'll be doing it with him, and we'll like figure out what's the sales process that works in the UK, right? So I think those are like challenges that we see. Like a natural ceiling, I think that's hard to talk about, right? There's obviously like at some point you don't have any more companies hiring hourly paid workers, but you know, we're very far away from that at the moment. So I think that's kind of how I see the challenges.
And especially with, you know, COVID and this entire digitalization, a lot of people have been going freelance. There is bound to be more and more people who will be, you know, eligible to work hourly, to work, you know, on a gig basis.
For sure. And, you know, the work does not look like it looked 20 years ago, and it definitely will not look like it does today in 20 years, right? Like, you know, you have people that are, you know, baristas on a Monday and Tuesday, they translate stuff on a Saturday, and then, you know, they deliver for Uber Eats on the Sunday, right? And all of this just makes your personal finances a lot more complicated. So finding something that can help solve all of this complexity and make it simple, that's going to be much more important in the future.
You mentioned that you're currently focused primarily on hospitality. Sure. Do you have, you know, plans to expand to other industries, other types of, you know, gig workers?
Yeah, so we're already working with some of the delivery companies today, right? The type of people that can jump on their bike, do 2 hours, and then, you know, cash out. But also, like, again, struggle to see where exactly am I going to end up salary-wise at the end of the month. We also have some conversations with really big retail clients at the moment that also makes a lot of sense, right? It's the same issues that you're facing if you're working as a cashier in a big supermarket as if you're a waiter at a restaurant. So like the issues are the same. The need for flexibility in the employees or like wanting to do something good for them and motivate them is the same. Retention is a big issue in sort of the big resignation that we're in right now, right? Mm-hmm. Like people jump from one supermarket to another, from one restaurant to another. So the issues are the same. So you have hospitality, you have retail, you have gig workers in general. And then there's, you know, healthcare as a whole, nurses, social workers, etc.
Yeah, there's an enormous potential for you to scale up your platform, scale up your company within different industries.
Exactly. But I think it's also like it's an art of staying focused, right? Like, sure, there's other things we can do. There's, you know, thousands of ways we could go with the product as well. It's such an exciting space because there's like been done so little for these types of users that there's just a lot of things that you can see you could help with, right? So I think similarly to how on a product level you need to be super focused, I think you also need to do the same thing on the like commercial level.
True. Okay, Jonathan, we talked a little bit about, you know, your company. We talked a little bit about the industry. I want to talk a little bit more about that financing that you mentioned at the beginning.
Sure.
You closed your seed round. Can you tell me a little bit more about the process? How did it all work? What did you learn from the process? I mean, you've had your pre-seed round, you had your seed round. What were some of the major differences that people need to know about when going from one round to the other?
They're very, very different, right? Like a pre-seed round is much more just your CV and a decent enough idea, right? Like, and that mm-hmm. gets you it's not that easy but like seed rounds are a lot harder. There are a lot more dynamics at place,
mm-hmm.
A lot more boxes you need to tick. And this whole, like, I'm sure a lot of people are talking about this, but this whole FOMO is a lot harder to manage at the seed round level. And I'm not sure how much mm-hmm. you can manage it, but you need to be much more running things as a process, right? And I think if I just jump into, like, the biggest learnings I had from raising a seed round is, one, you know, you get a lot better at pitching. You need to be fairly flexible in terms of what you're pitching as well, right? Like, they're not buying your business, they're buying the story that you're telling. Mm-hmm. And if you tell a bad story about a good business, you're not going to get funded, right? So you need to be super sharp on what it is that you're saying, right? So one, practice that, try it out, like maybe start with angels. And I think one thing I did the wrong way around was I started pitching funds and then like thinking, okay, I can get some value added angels at the end. But really, like, what changed the pace of my fundraising was once we started getting some of these like super connectors in, like people like Chris Murphy, Andreas Hilbig, Adam mm-hmm. Lasry, that just knows the ecosystem, right? Like, because they, if they think it's a good investment, that means a lot to other investors. At the same time, this is a tight-knit group of people that all communicate via WhatsApp about deals and stuff. So if you're not kind of on the inside, then it's really, really difficult to know what's going on. Whereas, like, if you have allies on your side that can help you, it makes a huge difference.
A lot of founders say, yeah, I mean, the amount of money is not really as important as getting, you know, people who can connect you with others, who can help you grow your company. That smart money aspect is much more important than, you know, the amount on the check that you'll be getting at the end.
Exactly. I think that's true. The smart money can kind of come from it can come from really small checks as well, right? Like, I'm not going to go into the specifics, but, you know, some angels come in with very small checks that you almost spend all of that money on legal fees. But the amount of, like, help you're getting from having them in mm-hmm. Makes such a huge difference that it's fine to set it up that way. And we have, like, a long list of angels that have all been extremely helpful since coming on board.
What are your thoughts on the European VC industry? Do you think that, you know, everything's going good, or that we have a lot, you know, of work to catch up, let's say, to some US VCs or Silicon Valley VCs that are always have been, you know, the gold standard of how things should be done?
I think that's above my pay grade to say. Like, one thing I will say is that my experience, like, European VCs are very driven by numbers and stats, which I think can be a little bit difficult at the seed stage, where you don't necessarily have enough stats to show. So like, that can be a little bit of a weakness, where I found, like, when discussing with American VCs and also Moonfire, who ended up leading our round, it was more around mm-hmm. concepts and like high level thinking and learnings that you'd gotten up until that point, rather than like, is your, you know, this stat exactly that or whatever. So I think in that sense, I think there's maybe some learnings to be had in the European VC space. But again, I think that's probably like beyond my pay grade.
When people talk about different rounds, they usually say, you know, pre-seed is where you buy the investor with the idea. Mm. The seed round is where you buy them, you know, with a working prototype. Mm. And then when you enter your, you know, series A, B, C, that's where, you know, the hard numbers come into play.
Yeah.
Is that something that really works, you know? I mean, you've gone through the process. Is that something that, you know, sounds right?
In theory, yes. The issue, I guess, is once you start having revenue, at a seed stage, they're still going to look at those numbers, right? So like, in some senses, some people have almost said to me, it's smarter not to have revenue because then, you know, revenue could be whatever, right? You just haven't like turned that button on. But as soon as you start having revenue, they're going to be looking at that. However, you know, the market is also changing, right? So I don't want like anyone to take anything from here that says like, don't do revenue. I think like driving your business by revenue is a great idea, especially in a market where we see valuations coming down quite a lot. Investors probably want to invest in solid businesses that have proven that that's going to be a way to get to profitability within like not too many years. So I think like the market might also be changing a little bit with kind of the macroeconomics changing.
What are your thoughts on bootstrapping?
I think it's fantastic. Like if you can do that, why not? The cool thing about venture funding is that you can start out by building a product and then selling it. And you can take a lot of upfront costs. So you don't end up like doing a lot of like consulting type, a very customized product for specific customers and then trying to like generalize that at a later stage as you might have to do in bootstrapping. So for me, venture funding is a cool way of building a business because you get learnings quickly and you understand like, were these learnings good enough to continue with this idea or were they not, right? Where it's like, if you bootstrap, you might have to wait 5 years rather than 2 years to get to those learnings. At the same time, if you bootstrap, then you're making money along the way and you kind of own it all yourself. So I can definitely see why bootstrapping is attractive. And I think it just depends on the case that you're building, right? I think with a product-led tech company like we are building, it wouldn't be like possible to bootstrap with the SaaS model we have. I don't think it would have been. So I think it depends on the business model you have, really.
Yeah. I completely understand. Okay, Anton. I want to talk a little bit more about you and specifically you as a co-founder and a CEO.
Sure.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about the things you're focused on the most? What does your day-to-day look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's just been a bit of a gear change, right? Like when we were 5 to 10 people, my day-to-day was like execute as much as possible in as little time as possible, just get in and get busy, right? Whether that's sales, product, recruiting, operations, finance, whatever, like get all of this done, right? And I think as you get to this stage, it's a little bit more about like getting into the helicopter. Like most of my time is spent ensuring that we recruit the right people, right? Because I think if you have the right people in, you have the right culture, then you've come a long way, right? Then it's a little bit hard to like get it completely wrong. So I think that's where I spend the most of my time. As I said, you know, I'm a product person. I spend a lot of time on user research before, and that's really where like I want to drive within the company as well. So I think my time is really spent on recruiting, culture, a little bit product, and then helping the sales guys out when they need it. But you know, they're very good, so they don't necessarily need my time that much.
Need your help, yeah. You mentioned culture. How would you describe the company culture at Old Gravy?
The culture that we've been building is really focused on like allowing people to do the job in the way they see fit, right? So people can work from anywhere. They can work whenever they want to. Like we don't put any kind of limits on that. We don't like micromanagement. We like to give people a direction and just like follow up and help them if there's anything in the way. So I think in that sense, there's an extreme like level of freedom within our company. One of the values that we have at our company is playful, right? Like we all want to like enjoy it when we're here. Like we are very social. We do a lot of social events. And then I think, you know, one thing that we kind of failed in writing down the first time around when we wrote our values down was excellence, right? Like everyone here is extremely passionate about like creating the best product in the world, like creating the best sales process in the world, and the ambition level is extremely high. So I think it's really like that pursuit of excellence and that skillfulness allows us to have a somewhere where people can have that freedom and we can have fun with each other. Because I think like really having a cool place to work and a cool way of working allows you to get the best talent.
You started your company in 2020. Mm-hmm. You've had your share, you know, of successes. You've had your share of failures. What would you say, what successes or failures really shaped you as a leader?
Oh, that's a big question. Which successes or failures really shaped me as a leader? I think I think I took a lot of learnings from some of my previous companies where like mm-hmm. I've been a leader at, right? Like I think like that's one of the reasons I ended up building a company myself is really saying, what do I think is the best working environment to be in, right? I've been at places where there've been an extreme, like really, really high targets, a lot of focus on like getting people to achieve that target and kind of like even mm-hmm. shouting at them if they didn't receive that, right? And I think I'm extremely bad as a leader in that environment. As I said, I hate micromanagement. And also I think people lose their creativity, they lose their spark, they actually become a lot worse if that's the way you kind of deal with them, right? So I think one learning for me has been like, you need that positive spirit to be in the company. If you lose that, then it's very hard to be a startup. I think the second thing is like over communicate. Like I have a tendency to think if I say one thing, then and people just remember it and they run that direction, right? And I think that's another thing that I've seen as a company grows really quickly. Like there's things that you assume that you don't need to say. That's like, oh, of course, all of us know this, right? And then I've seen mm-hmm. like companies breaking because you didn't repeat that. And you know, number 40 person that starts has no idea what your starting point was and why you did it, right? So you need to like be constantly communicating both on like your Monday meetings, like have academies where you talk about what the company is, where we're going, why what every mm-hmm. single person mm-hmm. is doing is really important in terms of where the whole company is going. So really like ensuring that if you are on a journey as a company, and not every company needs to be that, but if that's what you're kind of selling to your employees, that they come in to be part of a journey, then they need to understand, what does that journey look like? Where are we on that journey? And how am I sort of contributing to that? So I think, you know, let's talk about that as failures, right? That's like failures I've had in previous companies, where I feel like that's really something that we can never allow to happen in my current company. That's also why we're investing so much in having these coaches that everyone can go to. Everyone has a personal development path. I have chats to these coaches to figure out like what are the issues that I have, like what are people worried about, and then I try and rectify that by communicating as much as possible and as openly as possible.
Yeah, I like that mindset. I like that approach of having, you know, outside help. Because if you're looking for help within the company, you are all very subjective about the things and how are things working and what needs to, you know, change.
Yeah.
When you get that outside help that is, you know, objective, that can, you know, see your company as it really is, that can really, you know, supercharge the way you are growing, supercharge the way you are handling your problems. Because they see something different, something, you know, that you really need to work on versus the way you see the company as like, okay, this is great. This might be, you know, problematic, but it's not a big deal. And from the outside, it might really be a big deal that you need to work on.
Exactly. And it's very hard to say. Also, because like, you're in a different position when you're a founder, right? Like people don't necessarily like want to say stuff to you or, you know, so I think you need that help. And I think there's also something about values. One of our values is that we're human first, right? Like that means how do we speak to each other? It also means like, how do we build a product? But anyways, like that's a very free value to put up if you don't invest anything in it, right? Like what does human first mean, right? And for us, that's like, okay, that means we invest in humans. So we have social events. We have a personal coach who is pretty damn expensive, right? But he's worth it because then that really shows, okay, we're taking this seriously. Like we want you to grow within the company and with the company.
Especially in the IT, there's a lot of, you know, changing businesses. I mean, people say that, you know, you're like a year and a half or 2 years max at, you know, one workplace, then you change.
Yeah.
Then you're 2 years at another, then you change.
Yeah.
Helping people really grow within the company can really expand that aspect. And also you say, I mean, you mentioned at the beginning, you know, having, you know, ownership of the company is also an aspect that can help people stay longer, really take ownership of what they're building at the company.
Yeah. But also I think it comes down to like, Christian and I's conversation at the start is like, if we are building a success, right, we want everyone to take part in that, right? Because we're on a journey together. We can't build this like as a two-man army. And also, if you're successful with a venture-funded startup, you're going to do pretty well for yourself, right? So why not like share it a little bit amongst the employees? And I think, that also helps a lot in alignment of the company.
Okay, Jonathan, we're almost done with our time. So I have just two more questions for you.
Sure.
The first one would be, what advice would you give to, you know, young startup owners who are just looking to enter the market?
Now, I gave you my kind of pretext, right, which is I'm a little bit of a chicken. I wanted to see everything before I kind of like jumped into it. And I think like you just learn so much from doing something, right? So I think like A is like, it's not that scary, right? Like just do it, reach out to people that have done it, have a coffee, understand like what it takes.
Yeah, yeah.
Two, understand your users, right? This is where most people go wrong, right? They either they don't interview enough users, or when they do interview them, they say, hey, I have this solution. Isn't it great? And they're like, yeah, it's great. And then like, okay, now I build it, right? Well, it really needs to be about like, what are the problems that you have? Okay, I have these problems. Okay, that makes sense. Maybe if we did something like this, would that change the problems? Yes, it would. Okay, in which like actually going in and really like ensuring that every single thing you do, you ask the users in a non-biased way about. I think those would be my two pieces of advice.
Yeah, that research aspect is extremely important. And a lot of times people completely forget about it.
Yeah.
They have this brilliant idea. Yeah, I want to do this. This is going to change the world. I'm going to build it.
Yeah.
And when it comes to time, you know, to sell it to someone, then you found out, okay, nobody really needs this.
Yeah.
This is just a brilliant idea in my head.
Exactly. We were actually from the start very focused on this, right? As I said, like I'd already gotten companies to say they would pay for it before we build it because, you know, you don't need to have the product to actually sell it, right? And one thing is saying, oh yeah, that sounds nice. Another thing is saying, I would actually give you money for this. Like getting people to say that also gives you the confidence to go full speed ahead with the product that you're building.
Yeah, yeah. Because you know there's a market for that. And then you can go, you know, all in, as they say.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay, Jonathan, last question. What can we expect from you and All Gravy within this year and the next? What are some of your plans?
Well, I think the big thing is really like you're going to be seeing a lot more of us, right? You're going to see us across all of Denmark. You're going to see us in the UK. You're going to see us make a big difference to people's financial lives. I think those are the big things. As I said, there's a few big sort of like product things coming out where we really change the lives of the HR directors and restaurant managers as well. So expect big things. Like we're running super fast. We have a great team in place and now we're just putting capital behind it.
Excellent, excellent. I'm really looking forward to seeing you grow and scale your company. It's going to be a great story.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much for having me.
And we are done. But before you sign off, don't forget to subscribe if you haven't done that already, so you'll get notified when we publish new episodes. And leave us a review if you enjoyed this podcast and you learned something new. It'll be highly appreciated. And that's it. I'm Dorian. You've been listening to Highway to Scale, and I'll see you all in the next episode.